Hello and welcome to Epilogue, Press TV's book review. I'm Derek Conway. In this programme we shall review a new book called Resistance, The Essence of the Islamist Revolution by Alistair Crook. The author is founder of Conflicts Forum, an international body which engages with Islamist movements, and Crook has personally organised unofficial dialogues between Hezbollah and Hamas. Former Middle East Special Advisor to the EU High Representative, the author has facilitated ceasefires between Israeli and Palestinian forces. His immense knowledge of the competing forces within the Muslim orbit has produced a work of considerable detail, 302 pages of firmly argued thought based on the conflicts between Sunni and Shia Muslims and Western misconceptions of Islamism. Joining me to discuss it is Edward Lee, former Trade Minister and now Chairman of the UK Parliament's most senior committee, and Dr. Dawood Abdullah, Deputy Secretary General for the Muslim Council of Great Britain, and we hope also Alistair Crook as the programme goes on. Now, Dawood, if I come to you first, what did you make of Alistair's work? Were you convinced by it? He seems well informed. Did you think that?
Yes, I think it was a well-researched book. I think he went well beyond the rhetoric that we are usually familiar with in the political discourse, and he tries to unearth some of the historical undercurrents that inform the debate on Muslim-Christian relations or East-West relations. So I think in that sense he has made a remarkable contribution based on the depth of research in the book, and then of course the analyses and conclusions that he came to. I am, you know, convinced in that respect, but worried somewhat by some of the his concerns in his conclusions. For example, the continued demonization of Muslims in the West. He clearly asserts this at the end, and he also asserts that the Western use of military power or preference of military power over moral power will continue for yet some time. These are worrying concerns.
And do you think he was able to put his finger on the sort of competing views within the Muslim world, or do you think he was maybe too pro one section of society? Or?
No, in fact he drew a parallel, and he showed what was common, as it were, between the Shiite school and of resistance and that of the Sunni school as exemplified in Hamas. These differences, theological differences, they run very deep historically. But in the early 21st century, Crook comes to the conclusion that there is enough common basis for collaboration between the two.
I mean, I don't know what you made of the book, Edward, but I mean, do you think it's important for non-Muslim politicians, particularly foreign policy, to try and understand what's going on a bit more? Were you convinced by any of Alistair Crook's
arguments? Well, it's an academic book. It's a long book.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's quite pretentious in many ways, and I think some of the points I'm not quite sure what he's making. I mean, he made big things of what sort of Cromwell said, and to think that what Cromwell said it somehow influences modern-day politicians seems a bit unlikely. And he's got a big thing about Turkey becoming a secular state in the 1920s. And although these things are important and they affect intellectuals, they may be a sort of a substratum of the political debate, I'm not sure he's really put his finger on it. I mean, the real problem with the Middle East is not Islam, in my view. The real problem is that we've got a history of dictatorships, we've got a history of poverty, and we've got dictatorships deliberately stoking up popular resentment against the West, particularly, and stoking up Islamism, which has sort of turned back and bitten these dictators anyway. That's a real problem. And I think these rather long, convoluted theories that he comes up to do with our history and the West sort of trying to degrade Islam, I just don't personally buy it myself.
Well, it's interesting coming from an author like him. I mean, I think, as you say, Dawood, because of his peculiar background, the work seems very well informed. I mean, I'm not sure what his personal religious position is, but I mean, he does seem to have done a lot of work on it. Well, Crook does write with passion and conviction in his admiration for the tenacity of Islam, despite the immense odds faced, both economic and military. Let's take a look at this extract from an early part of his book, which sets out the scene for what is to follow.
Europeans have often struggled to understand how Islam, which arose in one of the poorest regions of the world, could have become such a transforming factor in history. How could a people who had lived on the margins of the world for so long rise suddenly to defeat the two superpowers of the day, Rome and Persia? How were armies assembled? How is the world so energized, so mobilized by these events?
Edward, you mentioned Turkey earlier, and you studied modern history as a student, which may be too many years ago for recall now, but I think Turkey is an interesting example because obviously the author refers to the impact of the revolution with Mustafa Kemal Atatürk bringing a secular power to Turkey and the ending of the caliphate, which he obviously argues is absolutely significant. I mean, how do you see that as a Western politician? I mean, do you think that the developments in Turkey are understandable and that, in fact, they should be allowed to join the European Union? Or are you
Well, yes, I think they're very understandable, and I think Turkey has been a major step forward. I mean, I don't claim to be any expert on this, but I think Turkey is an example for the rest of the Middle East. It's a democracy, not a perfect democracy, but it's democracy. It's a secular state where people have freedom of religion. It's deliberately stepped back from a sort of theocracy or a purely religious view of society. So in many ways, I think it's a beacon. And whether it'll ever join the EU, I don't know. I think it's just got to, probably it will, but it'll probably take another decade, another 15, another 20 years. I mean, there are arguments both ways, frankly. Yeah. I mean, there are arguments from our point of view, because if you have a big Muslim country like that joining the European Union and effectively aligning totally with the West, with NATO, with the European Union, that puts us our foot in the door in the Islamic world. We can proclaim Turkey as an example. I mean, I think a lot of people here are worried about whether we want to have another 50 million people having a right to work here. I mean, it's nothing to do with Islam, it's just another 50 million
it's
people.
It's a big nation. I mean,
it's a big nation, you know.
I mean, Turkey's been a member of NATO for many years. I mean, Dad, from your perspective, I think, as you know, a lot of people worried that when the present government in Turkey was elected, that maybe the balance between secular and faith would merge, and there were concerns about that, but that doesn't seem to have been the case, so maybe the concerns are less. But do you think the move in Turkey is still to want to be part of the European Union and side that with the Western end, do you think, or are they reconsidering that?
I believe that there is a sort of reduction of that desire that we saw in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, that push, that urgency, that has somewhat subsided. And given the recent events in the Middle East, in Gaza in particular, and the role that Turkey, you know, has emerged to play, that leading role in the Middle East, there is a view that Turkey is now reconsidering, you know, its position on the global stage. It is going back to its natural cultural homeland, where it can play a more influential role, where it would be more respected and appreciated for what it is. It has been knocking on the doors of Europe for more than two decades now, and on every occasion it has been rebuffed. So there is a rethink. That is one opinion. And I think this is somewhat the case. It will, because there is a political vacuum in the Middle East. Egypt is not playing the role it traditionally played, that of leadership, you know. And here, Turkey can easily fit in and be accepted as a major player. And I think the current administration has realized this, and hence its overtures in the negotiations between Syria and Israel and within the Palestinian national unity discourse.
Oh, so it's a big nation, but I get the feeling the French and the Germans are just never going to allow it to happen. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. Who knows? Edward, Alistair, in his book, compares jihad and argues that the Christian faith is sort of a passive, although I think if you look at the Inquisition and the Crusades, it's sometimes difficult to argue. And I wonder if, from reading this book, whether you think the exponents of a militant faith at Everwing, whatever they're calling, make just on the whole can never speak for the humanity, that they're always going to represent an extremist view which can never last. I mean, like the Cromwellians that he keeps going on about. Yeah. The Puritans were never.
I think this
survive.
Is a bit of an exaggeration in terms of the modern world we live in. I mean, there are Christians of all varieties, but I don't know that there are many well-funded Christian groups around the world today which are going around being terrorists, you know, this doesn't happen. So I don't think you can say, well, there's a sort of, all these religions have their extremists, all they have their moderates. I think Islam does have a particular problem at this time. Now, I know that 99% of Muslims are peace-loving, I know the Quran abhors violence, and I know all that, but it's undoubtedly true that the Islamic world does have a real problem with a tiny, very well-funded, very powerful, very violent sect or sects, and it has to address it. And we need to have more moderate Muslims who need to speak out, you know, as you're doing, obviously, in this program and in your writings and the rest of it, who must condemn this and say this is not true Islam. And certainly, if there were Christians who were going around, you know, setting off suicide bombers in Tehran or Iraq, I would condemn them round as we all would.
Yeah. But I think also within the Christian fold, you know, the rise of evangelical Christians in the United States and their influence on national and international policy, that has been well documented from the time of President Carter, 1978 onwards. Their influence has, you know, continually been on the rise, and it came to a peak during the last presidency of George Bush. I mean, researchers here in the United Kingdom, like Michael Prior, the Irish historian, he says that there was something like 33 million Christian evangelicals in the United States who assert tremendous influence. You have people like Pat Robinson, and you know, and
yes, but these people are not violent. They're not. They may not like evangelicals. They're not actually blowing people up. So I don't think you could equate the two.
We're going to come to this, and as I'll explain to you why. Though the author traces the centuries-old conflict between the competing sects of Islam, he contends changes of historic significance are underway. Let's take a look at this extract, which illustrates his thesis.
Both the Sunni and the Shia now have common ground. Whatever their historical differences, in two highly significant areas, the refusal to continue to accommodate and to compromise with iniquitous, aggressive, or infidel power, as Fadala termed it, and the requirement for a revolutionary struggle for reform and social justice.
Alistair, we're delighted to have you join us. We've also been discussing your book, and it'll be interesting to hear your views on it. But I think one of the things that we find came through it is your historical analysis, going back to Anglo-Saxons and the Puritans. And one of the things that seems to come through history is when competing sects within a particular religion are arguing their corner, ultimately it's about sort of military power, and the Puritans that you go to as an historical example, they ended up falling out with one another, and then a mini-revolution follows again. Isn't that the way things are really going to go when you see the competing forces in Islam at the moment?
Often it's, I think, portrayed in that way, but in fact what I'm saying in the book is that underlying this indeed is some key ideas, and it's the importance of the ideas and the principles. And what is being contested in some respects by the Islamists is much of what we see as modernity, and inverting it to a different form. So it's actually what is happening in a way, and certainly in one trend of Islamism, is a discussion about the nature of politics and about the end of politics. So they're saying, instead of having, if you like, a society that is based on markets, on market equilibrium and market efficiency, to which other ends are subordinate, you need actually to invert that whole paradigm and to have a society that is based on justice and on equality and on compassion, to which markets can play their part, but they have to be subordinate to those moral values. So there are ideas, there are also philosophical ideas that are quite profound, that are energizing and mobilizing Muslims. Of course, there's another track in that, in that there, like in Christianity, there's a much more literalist, reductive, rather more dogmatic form of Islam that has always been anti-philosophical and anti-rational, and it's usually from the splinters of this group that the West finds those that they describe as violent groups.
Well, I mean, it's a view you expressed, Edward, about your concern about embracing democracy, but it often seems to be that it's the young people who are the most vulnerable in all this. I mean, you must find with the Muslim Council that there is a concern amongst many older members of the Muslim community in Britain that, you know, their children, their grandchildren are becoming much more politicized, mm-hmm. and the media is always happy to pick up on that. But they don't, of course, represent everybody who's a Muslim.
Well, I think that the problem in the United Kingdom is that we're not creating a space where the young people can engage in political activism and political thought and explore ideas and political trends. What we have is an attempt to close down debates on campuses. We have professors being called upon to spy on Muslim students and to report on what their research and what the academic interests are in the name of security. We have, yesterday, I was at the University of Kingston. Students could not make a collection for Gaza because the group they were collecting for is proscribed in the United States, but it is approved by the British Charity Commission. And when they see these contradictions, these appalling contradictions, they feel alienated. They feel undone, you see, by the establishment. And this has to be addressed.
But do you think, honestly, given your immense research in this and your great knowledge of the region, is it more economic than philosophical, really? I mean,
it's more philosophical than
economic.
You believe
that is the case?
Yes. I mean, the whole point of the inversion is actually to reinsert some principles, moral principles, about how human beings behave to each other. This isn't social democracy, because social democracy essentially accepts the idea of the market, both in political and economic terms, and then tries to mitigate the problems that may arise from it. But Islamists are inverting that whole process to really say that actually how human beings behave to each other and how they act in the society, not only in religious terms is the key, but it's also much more than that. It's about trying to find a new understanding of the human being, not in a segmented, divided, compartmentalized Western fashion, but in one which puts him more closely in touch also with the objects, not only the I, the person who acts, but the objects, and to look at it, the world and the human being, in a much more, if you like, unified way, and not simply in this divided and compartmentalized. Of course, there are echoes of this in much of Western philosophy, and also, interestingly, also in psychology today. You see much of these things, and anxiety about the human being that does suffer from this, if you like, segmented personality and this compartmentalized, and which psychologists say is partly responsible for the alienation and the dissatisfaction of young Westerners. So there are parallels, although moving in a very different track from what the intellectual tradition of Islamism is. But if I'd like to come back a bit to this question of what we are touching on moderates, I think this is really very, very misconceived. First of all, because what I think we're trying to do, in a sense, is move back to what happened in the Treaty of Westphalia, which was the treaty at the end of the 17th century, which effectively ended the religious wars in Europe. And out of that treaty came the understanding that religion would simply become a personalized part of one's existence. It would be something, if you like, almost a sort of a lifestyle choice. You have this and you wrestle with this in your own conscience and in your own way. But of course that is not Islam. Islam directly requires you to struggle for justice and for a change in society that is in line with Islam. So within the bounds of the law, Muslims are required to do that.
Within Islam, which says you shouldn't be political. I mean, that's the whole difference about the line that a Sunni Muslim would take an attitude to government and the Shia Muslim would take an attitude to government. I mean, that's one of the points you make in your book. So are you saying that the entire Islamic community is now coming together with a common political view?
I'm not sure if you... this point is entirely accurate. I mean, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was the head of state. He administered justice. He ruled. He engaged in external relationships. In fact, he sent envoys to other, you know, places beyond the Arab Peninsula. This is statecraft. And he had treaties of war and coexistence with Jews in Medina. So this is the model. He is the model.
But in societies
in
with the majority...
In that sense, Muslims ought to be political.
But in societies with majority Sunni population, the governments have been secular, haven't they? I mean, if they've not had imams involved in the political process, and often by some force to stop that happening. So,
but what is quite clear, and you know, the Quran was not a political blueprint and doesn't contain, and in fact it stands aloof from even theological reflection. But it is a reminder to humanity of what it calls old truths that are well known to people, that men and women have to act to each other and find, receive people acting in terms of justice, equality and compassion. And they are charged with making a society, and a political society, that reflects that behavior. That is the way that people can reach their full potential in the Quran. So it is a political, it is very much a political process. Of course that has to be within the bounds of law in this country, but it is a charge to act in a political manner.
We could do with an hour to discuss this, but when we come to the end of the show, some final thoughts to leave you with. This detailed work both requires and stimulates thoughts. The author's analysis of the rise of Islamism and its impact on political activism in Muslim countries is perhaps a portent of things to come. Though the Western media portrays Islamists as medieval, we repeatedly see how effective is their use of technology, the World Wide Web, and modern communication strategies to motivate supporters. With the impact of the Obama presidency just beginning to emerge, we may be entering a period of comprehension amongst the world's political leaders that advocates of this author's stature can only help to advance. I would like to thank Dr. Dawood Abdullah, Edward Lee, and the author himself, Alistair Crook, for joining me. And if you have any comments or suggestions, we would like to hear from you at epilogue@presstv.co.uk. Again, that's epilogue@presstv.co.uk. That's all for this week. Thank you for watching.